Do you remember Varda? We read the book, remember?
Vaguely, yes.
All right. Wife of
Don't know.
Clifford. Manwe. Say Manwe. I'll cut it out so that it sounds like you're saying it. Welcome back, everybody. We haven't done a proper intro in a while. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Patrick Santino.
I'm Clifford Vickery. This is chapter 3 of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. 3 is company.
Yeah. Well, how you been, Clifford?
I've been good. Enjoying the weather.
Nice. Oh, the beach.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. I've been good, too. Let's jump into the chapter, though. Nobody wants to hear about that, at least.
Okay, sounds good.
So for this chapter, we finally start on this journey. So Frodo sells his house. They start their journey walking at night. It was super cool. And then they run into some black riders and they run into some elves. And we got a ton to talk about for that. So let's jump into it. And you give us the Cliff's Notes first.
So Frodo finally decides that it's time to leave the Shire based on his conversation with Gandalf in the last chapter. After a bit of ado, he decides he will make his way quietly out of the Shire on his 50th birthday. He decides to move to Buckland, which is in the east of the Shire, where some of his distant family members live and where he came from originally. He's going to sell Bag End and hopefully fade out of public life, which might give him some cover to begin a journey out of the Shire while no one's looking. Gandalf leaves, and Frodo packs up his belongings and sends them along to his new abode. He decides to make the few days' journey to his new place on foot with Sam, his gardener, and Pippin, whose Peregrin took, his old friend. And they set out walking at night, but not before Frodo overhears a strange character asking his neighbor about Frodo's whereabouts. He doesn't think too much of it, although it's a little bit odd. After hours of hiking, they hear hoofbeats from afar. Deciding to err on the side of caution, they hide. A figure cloaked in black, with face in shadow, arrives on a black horse. Frodo feels a very strong urge to put on the ring, but he resists, and the rider gallops off. They decide to stay off the main road after this incident, and make pretty decent time going forwards into the next day. They repeat the drill the next day, once again hearing footsteps and hiding. A black shadow appears and is sniffing them out, but just in time, the jingle of a troop of elves can be heard, and the rider disappears. The leader of the elf group, Gildor, recognizes Frodo and takes the company in, feeding them and giving them shelter for the night. After many an elf blessing, the three hobbits are left to their own devices.
Nice, nice. That was a good summation, Clifford.
Thank you.
Not going to lie, I paid pretty close attention to that Cliff's Notes, which means I might not have in the past to other ones. And I thought that one was really good.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, what'd you think of the chapter?
It was longer than I anticipated it was going to be.
Agreed.
I was kind of expecting another build-up chapter, you know? As we saw in the last chapter, sometimes these chapters, it's kind of like talking about having a meeting situation.
Yeah.
Okay, we're getting started. Okay, what's going to happen next? And then it just begins all of a sudden. And we got thrown into the action right away, I thought.
I know. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
I feel like these chapters, low-key reason you read the books as opposed to the movies. The best parts of this chapter, like the nostalgic, like charming parts of this chapter, don't come across in the movies, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this whole part of the book is a little bit condensed in the movies anyways.
Yeah, and it's understandable that it is, but this was awesome. All right, let's blow through the early plot first, and then we'll get to the meaty stuff.
Frodo's, he's in a little bit of a pickle. Gandalf's been hanging around. Gandalf is saying, you should really be going don't make haste, but don't go too slow either. And Frodo's, what am I supposed to do? I want to go. I can't just disappear. It seems like he's very cognizant that he can't pull a Bilbo at the start of The Hobbit.
Well, obviously.
Yeah.
But he also doesn't want to leave either. You know, like, he had been restless before, but now that it's actually come to it, he doesn't actually want to go.
Right. He's a little bit reticent.
Yeah, you do get that feeling. So anyways, he decides what? To leave on his birthday?
Mm-hmm.
Because he always liked traveling in the fall, apparently. I don't think that's an ideal time to travel at all, but okay. And then it was also funny too, because he never even well, of course, he's still missing Bilbo too, so that's also part of the reason. You know, it's his birthday. They both had the same birthday. Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably some factor there. But then he also like hadn't actually considered what direction he was gonna go,
mm-hmm.
which is weird.
Yeah, that kind of threw me for a loop when I read that, because yeah. If you know what's coming in the books, it's like so evident what the giant quest turns into. The thought that Frodo is like already aware that he has to leave the Shire, but doesn't even know where he's going to go. It's kind of a funny thought.
Yeah. And so then Gandalf has the line here. Maybe you're supposed to be the one that goes to like the cracks of doom. Maybe that's for others. Either way, you're not ready for that. So why don't you just go to Rivendell?
Mm-hmm.
Which was like, all right, that's a pretty good start. Kind of reminiscent of The Hobbit. Same with like Bilbo following Bilbo's footsteps.
Yeah.
So,
and except in classic Gandalf fashion, he kind of says, it's not that far, but it's pretty far. The road is easy, but harder than it was, and getting harder still.
Yeah. A little bit of everything. Yeah. I mean, Gandalf eventually leaves too, and you know, just classic Gandalf stuff. He's just like, so it's 2 months after their conversation, and he abruptly is just saying like, "All right, I gotta leave. I've been idle longer than I should." You know, that he's just like, "All right, I gotta go check some news out south, but I'll be back for your birthday party so that I can leave with you."
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, you know, like, he doesn't answer any questions. And again, it's a wizard, so it's like you get away with it.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's just like it's so cryptic that it's like, I don't feel this is productive. I don't know.
Yeah, if you would hope that in this situation he was like, I'll be here, but if not, do this,
yeah,
and I'll catch you here, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then, of course, the other big news was they're selling the house to the Saxville Bagginses, who we established suck from the first chapter.
Yeah, those are the folks. Do we meet it? We meet them at the end of The Hobbit, right?
Yeah, they were the ones, like, taking over Bilbo's house
at
the auction.
Right, preparing to take all of his stuff right when he returns. And
so, yeah.
Whoa, I'm still alive.
Yeah, but there's a line in there. Giants and other portents on the border of the Shire were forgotten for more important matters. Mr. Frodo was selling Bag End. Indeed, he had already sold it to the Saxville Bagginses.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, I think that kind of just highlights the shelteredness of hobbits, that gossip's the biggest news as opposed to strange things on the borders.
Right.
Yeah, because if we remember from the last chapter, it started off with Sam and other hobbits talking about crazy stuff, but now all that's to the wayside because the most important guy in town is moving out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, in the context of the last chapter, everyone's hanging out at the pub. And it's like, well, we talked about giants yesterday, so what's new today? Did you hear about Frodo? So, Frodo's going, and I thought this is sort of a clever plan that he's making as though he's just moving.
Right. Yeah. And he's moving to the far side of the Shire that's close to Rivendell too. So that's practical.
Happens to be where he's from.
Right. Yeah.
Or nearby at least.
That's where he grew up. Yeah.
Right.
And so, so they have the birthday party, but Gandalf's still not there. And so this is just like hyped on throughout the chapter, like Gandalf's not here. So, like, always just keep that in the back of your mind as all this stuff happens. So he had the party with, like, a couple close friends, and then they finished packing the next morning. And so Mary Brandybuck and Fatty Bulger, two of the friends, go on a cart with, the last truckload of his stuff to move it into Buckland so that they can, like, give him, like, a housewarming present, I guess?
Right. Get the house all set up for him.
I wouldn't really expect my friends to carry stuff for when I move, but it's pretty cool that they do.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, Sam and Pippin are going to keep him company as he walks to Buckland. Mm-hmm. And he wants to walk to Buckland because he kind of just wants to get ready for a walking journey, I guess.
Yeah.
That's his only reasoning.
Taking it easy, getting in the headspace.
Yeah.
Doing some physical conditioning as well.
up until the point that he's leaving, he was still waiting for Gandalf, and he was like walking down the road expecting him. And then he heard Sam's dad, the gaffer, talking to some strange person. And when he heard that, he was like, "All right, let's just get out of here. Let's go to Buckland right now. I don't want to talk to anybody else." Right.
Right. So they leave by night and make a little bit of a point to be quiet.
Right.
Although they're not scared. They're just trying to keep it on the down low, basically.
Yeah, so they leave at dusk, and then they're walking through the night, and then the descriptions, like, this is seriously the stuff that I love about this book. This is why I read it. I'll just insert a description here. As they began to climb the first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps in Hobbiton far off twinkling in the gentle valley of the water. Soon it disappeared in the folds of the darkened land, and was followed by Bywater beside its grave pool. When the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned and waved a hand in farewell. "I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again," he said quietly. When they had walked for about 3 hours, they rested. The night was clear, cool, and starry, but smoke-like wisps of mist were creeping up the hillsides from the streams and deep meadows. Thin-clad birches, swaying in the light wind above their heads, made a black net against the pale sky. They ate a very frugal supper for hobbits, and then went on again. Soon they struck a narrow road that went rolling up and down, fading gray into the darkness ahead, the road to Woodhall and Stock and the Buckleberry Ferry. It climbed away from the main road in the water valley and wound over the skirts of the green hills towards Woody End, a wild corner of the East Farthing. Pretty cool, right, Clifford?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the one thing, too, there was that, like, they go to sleep for the one night, you know, the first night, and that quote with the fox, I'm always, like, struck by that whenever I read it.
Yeah, it's a little bit weird because it personifies a fox.
Yeah, what does the fox say? It says, "Hobbits," he thought. "Well, what's next? I've heard of strange doings in this land, but I have seldom heard of a hobbit sleeping out of doors under a tree. Three of them. There's something mighty queer behind this. He's quite right, but he never found out any more about it." So I almost think, personally, that this is, like, the last vestige of the childish narrator from The Hobbit, and somehow this made it.
Right, a personified fox.
But again, like, especially when we think about the context of the prologue, when we went over that whole, like, who's the narrator of this story, it's like, this just doesn't fit at all. But I still like it. I still love it, but, yeah, it doesn't, this doesn't line up.
It gives me, well, I find it sort of like, I don't know what the right word is, like sort of mysterious, melancholy, something like that. Like, you get this sense of the outside observer watching this happen, where we've been observing the troop from there. We've been seeing everything from their perspective up to that point, and then you get this view from the outside, like, strange things are afoot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that kind of, like, sets the mood, too.
Right.
Yeah, this kind of reminded me of one of the books that I was reading, Tolkien and the Great War. That's what the Tolkien movie is based off of. They were saying early in that book, there was a quote, like, he went on a trip to the Cornish seacoast. So, what is it? Is it Cornland? Cornwall. It's Cornwall is the bottom part of England that sticks out. That's right near, like, the part of France that sticks out, you know? And so, like, he was on the coast there, like, you know, hiking around and everything. And there's a quote that he wrote in the book, and it said, "The light got very eerie. Sometimes we plunged into a belt of trees, and owls and bats made you creep. Sometimes a horse with asthma behind a hedge, or an old pig with insomnia made your heart jump. Or perhaps it was nothing worse than walking into an unexpected stream. The 14 miles eventually drew to an end, and the last 2 miles were enlivened by the sweeping flash of the lizard lights and the sounds of the sea drawing nearer." So that's a quote from, like, one of his night hikes like this, which I feel is kind of applicable.
Definitely. Well, let's keep going a little bit. I have a personal anecdote that this reminds me of.
Yeah, the other thing to remember about this section of the Shire in general is that this is totally England. Like, you know, just look up videos of England. I was fortunate enough that the Tour of Britain was going on all week, so it's like I was watching that. And it's like, yeah, this is exactly what they're hiking through. I know all about this. Yeah, so it gave me a good picture for when they set out on this journey. Next big thing, though, should we move on? walking song?
Definitely.
All right, so you want to read the song first to start?
Sure. This is the shorter one, right?
Yeah, the shorter one.
The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow, if I can, pursuing it with weary feet until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then I cannot say.
All right, so this song should be familiar, right?
Help me out. It sounds familiar, but I don't actually know where, what from. And I'm not just saying that because Frodo felt the same way.
I can tell you're not saying that. I can tell you're not saying that to be clever. You actually don't know. It was in Bilbo saying the same thing, or basically the same thing when he left in the first chapter.
To himself.
Yeah, well, Gandalf heard it too, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a couple of changes, which, you know, I don't know. We had other stuff to talk about in the first chapter, but like I really didn't actually have any notes for that, whereas mm-hmm. this one, it's like, whoa. Now I have a bunch of notes that I had to go through for the song. So there's a slight variation from Bilbo's to Frodo's song. So first of all, Frodo's speaking it, whereas Bilbo sang it. Mm-hmm. And then Bilbo has the line eager feet instead of, and here it says weary feet,
okay.
Which, you know, Bilbo's just starting and Frodo's finishing for the night, I guess. Makes sense to make that change. Mm-hmm. But Pippin basically asks, is this an original of Frodo's? And Frodo really kind of isn't sure. Like, he might have heard it somewhere. Obviously, the readers, besides Clifford, know that Bilbo already sang this. Like, we recognize this from two mm-hmm. chapters ago, right? Mm-hmm. But then again, maybe Bilbo and Frodo both heard it from the same source, and so, like, Frodo might not have heard it from Bilbo. Also, there's, like, 17-year gap.
Bilbo said this two chapters ago.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you were just saying at the beginning of The Hobbit.
No, two chapters ago, dude.
Okay.
When he set out, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyways, so there might be a 17, there's a 17-year gap, so like if Frodo had heard it from Bilbo, he could have forgotten by now, whereas the reader probably isn't reading these two chapters 17 years apart.
Mm-hmm. Pretty unlikely.
Other stuff to talk about? So most of these notes are coming from Tom Shippey's books, just so that the audience is aware, so that we give credit where it's due.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this line in here. There's a sense that the lines mean more than their composers know. May indeed be not personal compositions at all. They may also be brooded upon, to be repeated with new understanding much later. So with Frodo's variations, you know, Pippin actually says Frodo's version is not very encouraging and happy, whereas when Bilbo kind of said it in the last chapter with basically the same lines,
mm-hmm.
it was kind of a good, like, fun, like, upbeat, you're getting on your way and leaving, and it's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But the same lines can have a different feeling or meaning, and that's kind of because Bilbo and Frodo's setting outs are just so much different.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, you know, both are leaving Bag End, but on one side, Bilbo is leaving without the ring, he's just gotten rid of it, and then with no responsibilities at all, like, he's basically going to retirement, though he'd probably already been retired
for right.
the 60 years, whatever. Meanwhile, Frodo's going out with, like, not quite the weight of the world, but, you know, he knows he's doing a super important thing, and but he doesn't really want any part of it, but he's willing to take it on.
Right, right.
That's kind of what he's feeling there.
Which, kind of like I was saying in the last one, I find is a little bit weird for Frodo as a character that from the outset of the journey, he already has this weight on his shoulders. You know, like he's already weary at the beginning.
Well, I think that's what makes a great story, Clifford.
I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it's different than Bilbo beginning The Hobbit or Bilbo starting his retirement of sorts to Rivendell. Frodo's just in a distinctly different place, and I think that it has bearing on the rest of the story.
Well, what do you think is weird? Like, that he just accepts it or like, accepts, like, such a burden, like, right away? Do you think that's
maybe
weird?
That, like, we don't know a version of Frodo that doesn't feel this way. Like, he's weary from the outset. There's all of his character development.
Well, is he really
happens.
Weary right now? I don't know if he's weary right now. I think he's more just, like, nervous and, like, I guess serious kind of, you know? But okay. It's not like he's got, like, it's not like he's weighed down.
Okay.
Yet.
Okay.
I think he's just aware of the magnitude of the situation, and it's very intimidating, and that's affecting him already. I would say that.
Fair. Well, okay. You know. Then to put what I'm saying in a different way, all of the character development that we'll see in Frodo is built on that foundation.
Okay. You know, okay.
By no means is he a blank slate right now.
Yeah. Though he doesn't quite know what he's getting into either, though. Sure. You know, he's just holding the ring for a time for right now.
Sure.
You know, it's not like he's going all the way. Mm-hmm. Not that the readers know it's all the way. Anyways, I got a couple more notes on this road thing.
Okay.
So in addition to the song, there's also the dangerous business going out your door quote. Why don't you read that? Mm-hmm.
This is Frodo recalling.
It's like a couple lines down.
Yeah, Frodo recalling something Bilbo used to say to him. "It's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out of your door," he used to say. "You step into the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to. Do you realize that this is the very path that goes through Mirkwood, and that if you let it, it might take you to the Lonely Mountain or even further and to worse places?" He used to say that on the path outside the front door at Bag End, especially after he'd been out for a long walk.
All right, big line there. Kind of famous line. It made it into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I didn't really realize this at all, but Shippey in his books, this is Tom Shippey, of course, the author. I'll do like a special on my books, but he says the road, you know, like the road that's in this poem, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. what Bilbo's talking about here, like the road goes on. The road may be an image of providence. So we have an additional, like now we have an image for it. You know, we were talking about providence in the last chapter, but now it's like, oh, let's actually like, yeah, let's give it a symbol here.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, maybe it's flowing and taking you in one direction kind of, but of course along the road, especially if you're starting at Bag End, there's going to be thousands and thousands of intersections and choices that you're going to have to make.
Mm-hmm.
And as a traveler, you could even just decide to stop too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really only going to be like the willpower that's going to make this road straight, like go on the path that Bilbo's kind of talking about to where you want it to take you. And so then Shippey has this good line here. He says, "Accordingly, when Bilbo and Frodo say that they will pursue it eagerly or warily till it intersects by other roads, lives, wishes, and will then continue into the unknown, if they can, they are expressing a mixture of doubt and determination, exactly the qualities Gandalf so often recommends."
Because
obviously the song is talking about, I will follow if I can.
Right, right.
Even though they don't know where they're going.
Right. One thing that intrigues me right off the bat is, like, there's obviously a strong parallel to, like, the language of rivers. You know, like, time is a river. In this one, you don't know where you might be swept off to. And then in the last one that we read a little bit earlier, like the road goes down from the door until it joins some larger way where many paths in there and they meet, kind of like a river coming together. So I feel like river analogy is a pretty common way to describe people's, like, describe time and people's lives and movement through time. But it's also like the road implies more choice and more, like, determination, I guess. Like, you're choosing where...
As opposed to a river?
Yeah, where you're being swept along on a course, and you have less authority over where the river takes you. So
right, I would agree.
Parallels and a strong contrast to that, which is interesting.
Yeah. Should we... I don't know if I got much more to add. Should we just keep moving on?
Sure.
Let's move on to the Black Riders.
Okay.
Let's get into that. All right.
I realized that I misspoke in the Eclipse notes. I said that the Black Rider came on the first day, or their first night. It came on the next day, right?
Ugh, I said you did a good job, Clifford. What am I just... I guess I got to take it back. Yeah, so let's kind of just blow through the scene here just to, like, get all the details because it's kind of important, right?
Right.
So Sam hears a horse coming up behind.
Right.
Frodo wonders if it's Gandalf, but has a desire to hide. Where the desire came from, who really knows? All right,
mm-hmm.
That's a mystery. So they hide in long grass. I always kind of assume they're behind a tree, or like in the movie, they're like under, like in tree roots or whatever, you know? But then what comes up is a black horse and a black clad rider coming up, and it's like a full size grown man.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got a big black cloak and hood, and his face is shadowed and invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So he stops even with the tree that Frodo's next to. And then he bows his head, listening, and he starts sniffing for a scent, which is kind of mm-hmm. creepy. Not kind of creepy, it is creepy. And then Frodo has a desire to put on the ring, and he's moving his hand to put it on, and he thinks if he slips on, he'll be safe and he'll be good.
Right.
But then, you know, we got to remember, Gandalf was explicitly saying the entire time that he was with Frodo, like, do not use the ring. Don't ever put it on. And then all of a sudden, the rider breaks into a trot and just moves on.
Right.
And that was it.
I wanted to add on, when Frodo is feeling like he should put the ring on, he feels suddenly like, I mean, as I'm sure a lot of people have experienced something like this, where you have like a rational view of, or like a rational feeling about something, and then you're in a state or condition where you're like, start to rationalize yourself out of your rational response to something, where Frodo starts saying to himself, well, no, like Gandalf is being absurd. Bilbo has used the ring. I'm still in the Shire. It's okay. I can do this. This, I'm not being crazy right now.
Right.
It's the same thing. Like, I can imagine, this is kind of a lame example, but just like for me, like, let's say I'm doing a run. It's really hard. And I've told myself I'm going to go a certain distance for whatever reason. And then in the midst of it, once it's really hard, I start like reasoning in my head why I don't actually have to go the full distance or something like that. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah.
You start to talk yourself out of something that you've already decided on because you're in like an altered state, or you just like your mind is trying to trick itself, basically.
Yep, dude, I had the bad case of that. Like, SI running in the summer sucked because it's like, oh, I could turn around at every single block. Like,
right.
Just cut it short.
But I thought that was a pretty interesting detail because it's we can see already that whatever is happening to Frodo, whatever is making him do this, it's playing mind games with him. As you mentioned, we can counter that with saying that he has this inclination to hide, like this kind of vague feeling like he should hide and get off the road leading up to that.
Right.
Which actually helps him out.
I can't remember if it was the draft or this. Did they say like, oh, it might be Gandalf, and if it is, we'll just give him a surprise?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But he still just had a feeling. Like, and that might also be, the feeling might just be like, ah, you know, I'm trying to leave unnoticed and go undercover. So right. Like, maybe that was it, but, or he wants to scare Gandalf just to be kind of funny. I think that was like a, just to rationalize why he's going to hide, but
right.
Yeah. And then I don't know.
Another little detail that stood out to me is that the two others ran one way and Frodo went another way. So Frodo's already been like pulled off by himself by happenstance.
Yeah.
So it's like Frodo against this dark force. It's kind of an interesting like breaking down of his companions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was also interesting because the other two were completely flat, so they didn't see anything the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So Frodo kind of assumes the rider's looking for him.
Right.
Like as they start talking, as he starts telling Sam and Pippin about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pippin's kind of asking him like, well, Frodo, like, do you know something about this rider? Like, why would he be interested in you? You know, because Pippin's just like the friend who's out of it. Right. Whereas Sam was also saying like, oh, no. Actually, I actually know something about these Black Riders. Mm-hmm. They came up to my dad, like right as we were about to set out. And he said like one was looking for Frodo. Are looking for you, Frodo. So that was the guest that was the stranger that Frodo heard talking to right before he left.
Right. Who didn't see. He just heard over a hedge or something like that.
Right. So I don't know. So Pippin, it seems, is pretty like curious about this and trying to pry for answers, which you know, he's probably doing that because he's friends with Frodo.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of fair.
Pippin doesn't know about the ring, right?
No. As far as we know.
Right. So Sam overheard some of Frodo's conversation with Gandalf. So we can assume that Sam is a little bit naive, but might be clued into certain big aspects of what's going on.
I think we can assume Sam's like, he knows pretty close to all of what Frodo knows. I think you can assume at this point.
Okay.
Sam just doesn't get just to get roped into this adventure and not get to know about it.
Right.
But I think he knows that Pippin, they're going to Rivendell too.
Okay.
Whereas Pippin's like clueless. He's just helping Frodo move.
Right.
I don't know. We could talk about Pippin, but I think we'll do that in another chapter because we got enough to talk about here.
Let's keep going.
So they start. So after that, they decide to take the offshoot of the main road, mm-hmm. like the main highway of the Shire. So they're on like a smaller road.
Right.
And so then they start humming and they sing the second song that's in there, mm-hmm. which we're not going to talk about, but it was kind of cool. I liked the detail that Bilbo made the words to it. To a tune that was as old as the hills. I was always wondering, like, to a tune as old as the hills, is that like something that the English people are in on? Like, do they know what's the tune that's as old as the hills? Mm-hmm. But I guess it's not.
I think it's just a figure of speech. Like, it's been around longer than any of us type thing.
But I wouldn't have been surprised if it was, like, just a classic tune to, like, some English folk song.
Mm-hmm,
you know, and, like, that, like, English people would be clued in to know what it is. But apparently not. So I guess I had my hopes too high. Let's see. But then what? They stop for dinner, and then they keep walking, and then they sing the song. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they finish the song, they hear hooves again behind them off the main road.
Right.
Which this is, like, starting to freak them out. They had also forgotten all about the Black Rider at that point, which I thought was kind of funny. You know, like, typical Hobbit. Well, I don't know. We'll see that. But that's actually typical Hobbit stuff to do. And so then they're, what, they're hiding in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And the shape's, like, tracing their exact trail. Like, he's going to come up to him. And then he's, you know, they're all super nervous. And this is, like, Tolkien's doing a good job, but any reader's nervous. Like, even if you know what's going to happen.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, elves come down. And they shoo him off.
Upon the hearth the fire is red, beneath the roof it is a bed. But not yet weary are our feet, still around the corner we may meet a sudden tree or standing stone that none have seen but we alone. Tree and flower and leaf and grass, let them pass, let them pass. Hill and water under sky, pass them by, pass them by. Still around the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate. And though we pass them by today, tomorrow we may come this way and take the hidden paths that run towards the moon or to the sun. Apple, thorn, and nut, and sloe, let them go, let them go. Sand and stone and pool and dell, fare you well, fare you well. Home is behind and world ahead, and there are many paths to tread through shadows to the edge of night, until the stars are all alight. Then world behind and home ahead, we'll wander back to home and bed. Mist and twilight, cloud and shade, away shall fade, away shall fade. Fire and lamp and meat and bread, and then to bed, and then to bed.
We got to get into the section of that I was looking most forward to in any of these early chapters.
Okay.
The elves in this scene are just awesome. Like, this is what the book's about. Like, I love these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So just let's blow through a little plot first, and then I'll try to describe why I love it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sam's like super excited to see these elves, which is pretty interesting. Like, he doesn't even care about the Black Riders. Like, Black Rider was probably the scariest thing he's ever seen in his life so far, and now he doesn't even care about it.
Well, on the flip side, Sam probably didn't see much of the Black Rider, and to him it's just some strange guy on the highway, right?
I guess, but he puts it out of his mind so quickly that it's like close to unbelievable. But that's actually a reflection about, you know, kind of what Sam prioritizes. Like, he wants to, he's heard all Bilbo's stories about elves and everything, and he really just wants to see elves. And it's kind of, there's a bunch of, like, desires in this book. Like, there's desire for power and, like, wielding the ring and everything, mm-hmm. which is a bad one. But then there's cool ones like this, where Sam's just like, yeah, I want to interact with higher beings than me and see something cool, like elves and everything. And it's, like, respectable. I think we all want to do that, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the elves come down, walking and singing, and one voice is over the other, singing in the fair elven tongue. And so the song that's in the book is a translation.
Mm-hmm.
We'll read the song in a second. Frodo recognizes them as high elves based on the language, and there's not many high elves left east of the sea. Remember, Valinor is west of the sea, right? So these ones are still in Middle-earth,
right,
which is east of the sea. Okay. As the last elf passes, he stops and greets Frodo. Somehow you could tell he was around.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's just typical cool elf knowledge, I guess.
Right.
How they can do that, I don't know. He starts commenting about how there's, like, three hobbits out at night, and it's, like, the strangest thing they've seen since Bilbo left, because, you know, most hobbits are not campers.
Right. I was going to comment on that. It's a diversion now, but...
Yeah, go for it.
Compared to what we know of hobbits from The Hobbit, where, you know, they like to eat a lot, and they don't like to push themselves too hard, it seems like these guys are really trucking it along, hiking at night, sleeping on the ground.
Oh, no, they're getting such... They're getting such a late start, though, and, like, they're taking so many breaks for food.
Okay,
I don't know if this is really huffing and puffing.
Okay.
I think this is, I mean, it's better than the average hobbit, but I think they're still close to leisure.
Regardless, it's remarkable to the elf that there are three hobbits out and about at night.
Right, and so this elf is Gildor Ingolion of the House of Finrod. Ooh, Finrod. He was cool. He was in the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we'll talk about him at some point, but not tonight. He says, Gildor Ingolion of the House of Finrod, we are exiles, and most of our kindred have long departed, and we, too, are only now tarrying here a while, ere we return over the great sea.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, like, Frodo's starting to chat with them, and then Pippin kind of blurts out, he's like, all right, tell us about the Black Riders, oh mighty ones.
Right.
So Gildor, then he starts kind of, he's frightened, not really frightened, but struck.
Yeah, he suddenly knows something's up. He's like, how'd you know about the Black Riders?
Right, he takes interest in that because it's like, uh-oh, those things aren't good news.
Right.
And so then he decides, all right, he's going to have he's going to have the hobbits travel with them for the night so that they can stay safe there.
Just some logistics questions. I was curious reading this. My general impression is Frodo and his friends are in the Shire. They're moving east across the Shire towards Rivendell. Meanwhile, the occasional elf passage through or near the Shire are typically elves from Middle-earth going to the west, to the Grey Havens, the west coast of Middle-earth, to sail for the Undying Lands. So generally, it's groups of them walking west through the woods. Frodo, presumably...
They weren't on their way right now west.
Okay, they're just...
They're still just hanging out.
Okay, they're just walking around.
Yeah, when they say, like, they'll return over the sea soon, it's like, well, that's an elf, you know. It's not like it's going to happen in a month. Right.
It could be hundreds of years.
There's probably multiple years left.
Understood. Okay, so they're presumably moving east on this road as well. Take Frodo and his friends in, and they continue to walk east.
Yeah, well, on first reading it, though, the Black Rider would have been coming up right behind Frodo. Right. And so then I would have assumed the elves were coming from the different direction to scare him off, and then the Black Rider went back the way he came.
Right.
But I guess it didn't really... I guess that's just wrong, because they go west after.
Right. Presumably, you know? It never says so.
Right. Yeah, you know, maybe that's like a little fun mystery that people studying the books, you know, in hundreds of years later can, like, comment on. Because there's probably stuff like this in real myths where it's like, oh, this isn't really... assumed like which way they're going or whatnot, you know, and you could write like a whole commentary on it, I guess, but we're not gonna. Let me try to describe why I think this scene's so cool. Here, I want to try to give a good picture. So this reminds me of the end of the greatest Disney movie of all time, Fantasia. Look it up. It's at the end of Fantasia, they just had like the scary like Bald Mountain scene where there's like the monster on the mountain and it scares all the little kids because how could it not? And then all of a sudden it breaks out, and to finish off the movie, they start having the Ave Maria scene. It looks like, in my opinion, I think it's like, I don't know, it's hooded people carrying candles like walking around, right? I don't know, I kind of assume they're nuns, because then they end up walking into what looks like a church. If you watch like the making of the movie, originally it definitely was a church with like a statue of Mary at the end, who's obviously Maria. You know, walking through the woods, singing songs like this is exactly what the elves are doing.
The elves take on this religious glow almost.
Snow White, O Lady Clear, O Queen beyond the western seas, O light to us that wander here amid the world of woven trees. Kilthariel, O Eldareth, clear are thy eyes and bright thy breath. Snow White, we sing to thee, in a far land beyond the sea. O stars that in the sunless year with shining hand by her were sown, in windy fields now bright and clear we see your silver blossom blown. O Eldareth, Gilthaniel, we still remember, we who dwell in this far land beneath the trees, thy starlight on the western sea.
The company is walking into the wooded hills. Sam walked with the elves in a dream, with a facial expression half of fear and half of astonished joy. Pippin was dozing off as he walked, elves were guiding him to not fall. And high away in the east swung Remoreth, the netted stars, and slowly above the mist red Borogil rose, glowing like a jewel of fire. Then by some shift of airs all the mist was drawn away like a veil, and there leaned up, as he climbed over the rim of the world, the swordsman of the sky, Menno Vegor, with his shining belt. The elves all burst into song. Suddenly under the tree a fire sprang up with a red light.
They proceeded under the starlight to have a meal prepared by elves. Pippin afterwards recalled little of either food or drink, for his mind was filled with the light upon the elf faces, and the sound of voices so various and so beautiful that he felt waking dream. But he remembered that there was bread, surpassing the savior of a fair white loaf to one who was starving, and fruits sweet as wild berries and richer than the tended fruits of gardens. He drained in a cup that was filled with a fragrant draught, cool as clear fountain, golden as a summer afternoon. Sam could never describe in words, nor picture clearly to himself, what he felt or thought that night, though it remained in his memory as one of the chief events of his life. The nearest he ever got was to say, "Well, sir, if I could grow apples like that, I would call myself a gardener. But it was the singing that went to my heart, if you know what I mean."
Frodo sat eating, drinking, and talking with the light, but his mind was chiefly on the words spoken. He knew little of the elf's speech and listened eagerly. Now and again he spoke to those that served him and thanked them in their own language. They smiled at him and said, laughing, "Here is a jewel among hobbits." Pretty cool. Pretty cool. I don't know. For anybody that read the movies and then was, or for anybody that saw the movies and then was inspired to read the books, I don't know. I kind of always tell people, it's like the parts that your favorite parts of the movie are not going to be your favorite parts of the book. Right. Well, this is one of my favorite parts of the book, and it's because of, I don't know, just the whole air of it, I guess, you know, and it's, and like the movie, yeah, like the movie as best as it can do. And I can even say it did a good job. It just still doesn't really compare to the book. Like, this is just masterclass.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, I can't think of the word. It immediately conjures to mind very dramatic imagery. Kind of just like you were saying earlier, I think the Fantasia thing's a perfect reference. Like it really has this like mystical, magical nature to it.
Yeah,
the elves are something from another world, in the best way possible.
Yeah, they are. Like the example that people kind of bring up, like one of the authors I was reading, Rutledge's book. Yeah, she was saying like, well, it's interesting that Sam kind of mentions an apple, because is that kind of like a reference to like Eden? Because the elves are almost kind of like unfallen humans, like man in its perfect state almost.
Right.
And it's like there have been attempts to like write fictional accounts of like what that could be like. Like C.S. Lewis had an attempt too, but Tolkien never explicitly said it, but these elves kind of are like that too. And it's like, I don't know, he does a good job. And maybe he's not even going for that. Maybe he's creating something else, but whatever he's doing with the elves, it's a good job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Let's actually get into it though, about what the song was about, what's going on here with these elves here.
Yes.
So they were talking about all these invocations to Elbereth. What is she associated with based off the lyrics of the song, if you had to guess?
I would say,
besides the fact that she's across the sea.
Stars, eyes,
yeah,
snow.
Yeah, stars for sure. So there's kind of like two images that kind of come up. They kind of view the stars as the flower of the queen who's beyond the western sea.
Okay.
The stars are kind of like her garden almost, you know, like that's okay, what she's creating, which we'll get into in a second. But then there's also the opposite, where it's like they're in woods and exile, you know, and it's like, all right, they're literally in woods now, but that's not the point of the song. What they're kind of saying is like, we're in woods and the only thing that we can like see to our native land is the stars above. Like that's our only connection to the native land, because they're talking in the song, they're saying this far land, as in Middle Earth, is the far land, whereas Elbereth's land across the sea is their real home. Mm-hmm. So
and
these
the
people
only thing
are,
it shares is the sky.
Yeah, so these people are exile.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, that's going to be the biggest theme with like the elves throughout Middle Earth here. Like, I don't want to get too far into it, because I want it to like develop as we see more elves, but
right,
that's a huge, huge keynote about these elves, is that they are, they're exiles. This is like, this is kind of the end, because lots of them are leaving the Grey Havens, you know? Like, that's one of the cool things about these elves, is that they're kind of elusive.
Right.
this won't last forever. Like, we're seeing this fade from the world, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which makes them all the more beautiful, actually. Because it's sad that they're going to leave, you know. And who would want to see these elves go, right?
Right. It's something that we'll come back to throughout the book. But personally, I've always felt like this aspect of the story is like a subtext or like an overlay that's not immediately relevant to the plot, but it makes me like melancholy for, I don't know, Tolkien captures like the changing of the world and like these elves who are kind of mysterious and magical passing out of this world and times changing, maybe for the darker, maybe for the better, and that unstoppable, intractable changing of time, he does in a very powerful way. And I've always thought that's like a particularly moving and beautiful description. This is one little glimpse into that.
I think I mostly agree, besides that, like, yeah, the elves' background isn't super, super, super particular to the plot to like make sure you understand like what's going on.
Right.
Yeah, the whole aura around them is very essential to the story still.
Right.
Yeah, which is basically what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess without giving up too much ahead of time, we saw in the last chapter that we're kind of setting up this good versus evil. Frodo will have to undertake some sort of quest in an effort to destroy the ring. That seems to be the primary narrative, is Frodo has the weight of the world on his shoulders as he's going up against the darkness spreading over the world. And related but separate from that struggle and that conflict is this like altering of the world, like this, the sort of goodness and purity represented by the elves fading out of the world is not really, at least in my impression, is like related but not directly tied to like the darkness spreading over the world from Sauron. It's more of a different, it's a different passing of time. The world is becoming a different thing.
Yeah, which is, I don't know, we all kind of see that in our own lives too. And that goes back to that, we've mentioned the quote before, the history is a long defeat quote. I still don't want to fully dive into it now, though I'm starting to better understand that, but it gets to that, like, everything's going to move on, or everything, like, decays or dies, or, you know, like, there's beginning and end to life, I guess.
Right. Nothing gold can stay.
So let's actually talk about who Elbereth is.
Yes.
We're mostly going to get this out of Silmarillion, because if you read the Silmarillion, you'll have an idea who Elbereth is.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Silmarillion, her name is, her main name that they use to refer to her is Varda. Do you remember Varda? We read the book, remember?
Vaguely, yes.
All right. Wife of?
Manwë.
Okay. All right, so obviously Manwë is the head of the Valar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, remember that. So that's actually the problem. You know, I've started to realize this. Like, whenever we're like referencing the Silmarillion about stuff, and we're doing it in such a like haphazard, out of order way, which is also the point. Like, I intentionally do that, but like, most people won't have read the book, so then it's like, ugh, all right, we have to go back and rehash everything. Like, you remember this? You remember the map? You know, but I guess this just comes with the territory. We're gonna have to keep doing it.
Right.
But anyways, all right. So Varda and Manwë are basically husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the Valar, and then they're like the Ainur, so they're more so like the equivalent of angels, because they're still like the head god Iluvatar above them,
right?
But then they also function more so as just like the Greek gods, like Zeus and everybody.
Yeah, they're like demigods.
Yeah, so kind of imagine Varda as Manwë's wife.
Mm-hmm.
She's known as the Lady of the Stars, and notably Melkor, who was the bad guy before Sauron.
Mm-hmm.
Melkor feared her more than all others.
Do we know why?
The only reason I can come up with that is when we... I'll get to you in a little bit. I'll mention that once we finish this conversation. All right. So of all the great ones who dwell in the world, the elves hold Varda in most reverence and love. Okay. So she's the star kindler. So like all the gods, they kind of specialize in one thing. Like Manwë's the god of the airs. So it's like, you know, he's got birds under his command and he like watches over the skies and everything. And then there's Olmo, who's like the water god and whatnot. You remember all this?
Mm-hmm.
And so Varda is She's the one for like the night sky and the stars. Like that's what she specializes in. Right. And so she's the star kindler. So if you actually, you might not know, but when Middle Earth first was created, there was no sun and moon. And so Varda starts setting up stars as light for the people in Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing that they have to go off. No sun or moon yet. Mm-hmm. So after Valinor was set up in the west, and then Middle Earth is just under the starlight, she starts to create like a fresh new batch of stars. And so she starts creating all these things, and it takes her a long time. And she's including creation of many constellations as well. Mm-hmm. And so finally, there's a line in here. High in the north, as a challenge to Melkor, she set the crown of seven mighty stars to swing. Valkyrka, the sickle of the Valar and sign of doom. So I believe that one is when she says high into the north and the seven stars. I believe this is the Little Dipper, because this will have like the North Star in it. Mm, like I believe okay. The constellations will be the same constellations that we see when Tolkien's talking about it. And like north, you know, obviously North Star. And that's where Melkor was laid, located, like his fortress was in the north. So mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like a sign of doom to him. And it is at that time when she finishes all these constellations, that's when the first elves awake. So like the first batch of elves, obviously they have kids later, but like there's a group of elves that awake because they were put in by Iluvatar, who's the head god. Mm-hmm. And they're the first children of Iluvatar. Men are the second children. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of elves that awake first, and they awake on the shores of Cui Avon, which is the waters of awakening. And the very first thing that their eyes see, because they're laying down and they just look up, and the first thing that they see is Varda starlight. And so because of that, she's who they hold most dear. Like that's who they love the most.
Okay.
Within the Middle Earth context, that's like what these, you know, these songs to Elbereth or Varda are doing, because Elbereth's just another name for her in a different language. Mm-hmm. But back to Tolkien in the real world, these Elbereth hymns are referencing something else. And so for them, Elbereth is the queen beyond the western seas and the light to us wanderers here, mm-hmm. which sounds very familiar to Tolkien, who is obviously a devout Catholic. And so that sounds a lot like Mary, queen of heaven, or the ocean star, or the guide to all the wanderers here below. I don't know. If you ask me, this is the first specifically Catholic example of something that's in this book, which is like the Catholic devotion to Mary. I just thought it would be worth the time to actually go into like, well, why is Mary like the queen of heaven? Like, why is that a big deal?
Right.
So where does that come from? Because he is like intentionally doing this.
Yeah.
But why does he think that this would be important? Obviously, in Christianity, Jesus is the king because he's Christ the king, right?
Yeah.
So if there's a king, there's probably a queen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Maybe not always, but in this case, there definitely is. You know, but who would be the queen to Jesus, if you had to guess?
The only women I associate with that story are his mother, Mary. And I feel like every now and then you hear about Mary Magdalene, but I don't really know anything about her.
Yeah, that's not... Yeah, that one's not accurate. That's like the Da Vinci Code, like, spread that, I think.
Okay, cool.
So it's like... So in the medieval world, obviously, you would traditionally say, like, well, the wife of the king is the queen, right?
Right.
But in the ancient world, how it worked, it was actually different. It was the mother of the king was, like, the queen mother, and she was, like, the most important queen.
Kind of like we saw in Game of Thrones recently.
No, Game of Thrones, they tried to do that because the wife was typically the most important, but then...
Okay, gotcha.
Anyways, the reason for that in the ancient world is because lots of these kings had multiple wives, so mm-hmm. it's like, well, how do you pick, you know? Versus the case of Jesus where it's like, well, he had no wife, obviously, like, whatsoever.
Right, but that was the tradition at the time.
Yeah, so not only was, like, the queen mother the most important and in charge, but if you look in, like, the... Especially in, like, the Book of Kings, like, the kings that are after David, like Solomon and everybody, mm-hmm. you see people asking the queen mother to go put in a good word with the king because the king's about to rule, like, a decision for them about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that's where the Catholic idea, like, where you pray to Mary comes from.
Mm.
But it's, like, pray to in quotes because it's more like you're asking her to say a prayer for you, you know, like, because every prayer ends with, like, pray for us.
Right.
And so that comes from this, which is like, yeah, she's the queen mother, and who's going to be able to put in a better word than the mom of the king?
Right.
So it goes back to like the biblical traditions here.
Interesting.
I mean, like the whole, like if you actually think about like the whole Hail Mary prayer, like the first half of it is just like titles for her.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second half is a couple more titles, and then it just says at the end, it's actually like, pray for sinners now and at the hour of death. That's it. Like, that's the whole prayer. Like, right. That's all you're really asking her to do. It's like, pray for you now and pray for you when you die.
Mm-hmm. To tie it back to the book, you're saying we have a clear connection to Catholic theology here.
Yeah. So these songs, though, it's like, well, I mean, we already give the example of the Fantasia story where they're seen where they're singing Ave Maria. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's like, this is what the elves are doing. They're basically walking around singing, like, you could say Ave Maria or Salve Regina, any of like the famous like Mary songs.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like the Salve Regina one too. Like, there's the prayer, Hail Holy Queen, which is what that means. But that prayer goes, Hail Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, our sweetness, and our hope. To thee do we cry, poor banished children of Eve. So listen to that already. Poor banished children of Eve. To thee do we send up our sighs, mourning and weeping in this valley of tears. Turn then, most gracious advocate, thy eyes of mercy towards us. And after this, our exile, show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus. O clement, O loving, O sweet Virgin Mary, pray for us, O holy Mother of God, that we may be worthy of the promises of Christ. So the exile part, everything that we said about the elves, like they're all leaving and everything. Mm-hmm. But then in addition to this too, like that might be, we got to let this develop and I have to read more about it too. Like, intentionally don't know like a full set of notes for this, but there might be a connection between like Christians associating themselves as exiles with the elves who are also exiles too.
Okay.
But that, I believe, will develop that further as we meet more elves.
Okay.
Again, to reference the forward episode, there's, as far as Tolkien quotes go, it's like semi-famous that he said, like, this is a fundamentally Catholic work. If you read his letters, people are asking him about like these kinds of scenes, like, well, is this supposed to be like a Marian image here or whatnot?
Right.
And Tolkien admits in his letters, he basically says, in reference to Our Lady, upon which all my small perception of beauty, both in majesty and simplicity, is founded. Basically, people would write in and say, like, this is a reference to this, right? And he's just basically like, oh yeah, you caught it. Good job. Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. And he's basically saying, like, this is my inspiration for beauty. That kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, this is what's important to him as he's writing this, like theological beliefs like this. Mm-hmm. And they're basically essential to Middle Earth too, as we'll continue to see. But it's still cool because even if you don't like hold those beliefs yourself, you can still kind of enjoy the story. I mean, I think it enriches it, but you know, some people might just say it gives another layer of depth to it or authenticity to it, but you know, they don't really care. I don't know. I highly enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I'm intrigued as well. Yeah, I want to stay tuned for more. I'm very prone to like when we have an analogy or a comparison or something like that, I want to see like all the connections or like all the parallels. So like you making the comparison for Elbereth being kind of like Mary Queen of Heaven, I'm inclined to like line the two up and want to like.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's not perfect.
That's what
yeah.
I mean. I don't expect it to be.
Right.
I'm just like naturally very prone to like want to see all the parallels constantly, so I'm intrigued to stay tuned for what we see of the elves going forwards, because it's something about the books, like I in an abstract way I recognize the Christianness or the Catholicness of the work, but there's enough like peculiarity in there that it's hard to make sense of what certain yeah. things mean. And like to take the elves for example, we're saying they're a little bit portrayed as humans before the fall type thing, like they're pure and above the ills of the world basically, and yet they're coexisting with men who we know are flawed in Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Much in the way we could say like humans after the fall in the Bible, but they're coexisting, you know, which is kind of interesting. But then also the elves are leaving the world, so where's the world going? How do the elves relate to each other, to the gods? It's all very intriguing to me, and I guess I want to see the analogy pushed a little bit further.
You know, as far as analogy goes, you're not going to get something perfect. Right. Like, that goes back to the applicability versus the allegory.
Right.
But as far as Elbereth goes, too, it's like, well, as they function, too, Elbereth's supposed to be, like, an angel or even a goddess or whatnot, which Mary isn't. She's, like, fully human.
Right.
But the way that they're reverencing her is basically, like, spitting image as far as I'm concerned or can tell.
Okay.
Also, that reference back to this, that reference that Melkor feared her above all others.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason that I could even think to explain that is like, well, Satan, he feared the Virgin Mary in the same way too.
Interesting.
Because she basically supplanted him.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh shoot, we still gotta talk about we still gotta do the Gildor Frodo conversation.
Okay, so let's keep it rolling. So we've met the elves. They show up. They treat the hobbits to a bit of a feast. And Pippin and Sam are basically both in awe. We heard Sam is going to remember this for the rest of his life as one of the key events, which is an important thing to keep in mind going forwards.
Yeah.
And then Frodo continues to talk to Gildor. And this is where the conversation turns a little bit dark, I would say.
Right. Pippin goes to bed and Sam falls asleep at Frodo's side. All right. And so Frodo and Gildor, they talk about many things, mostly sad and ominous. Frodo asks the question closest to his heart. He's like, well, have you seen Bilbo? Mm-hmm. And Gildor says, yes, twice. Once when Bilbo is leaving and once more, and he doesn't say any more. Mm-hmm. And then Gildor can kind of tell, like, he can read Frodo's heart, basically, and he knows that he's leaving the Shire, and he knows Frodo's doubtful that he'll ever return or complete his task. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically kind of what they get into. I didn't really find it very dark, Clifford.
Well, I mean, just in that they're moving beyond the festivities of the night.
Yeah, it's serious. It's serious, yeah.
The adults have stayed up late to speak quietly.
They bring up the Black Riders again, which Frodo's very concerned about. And so Gildor's like questioning, like, well, didn't Gandalf tell you anything about these guys? Like, what was he doing? And there's an interesting line there that Frodo was saying, like, yeah, I mean, you know, I expect danger, but not so soon. Can I walk in my own Shire safely? Mm-hmm. And Gildor has the interesting line there. He says, but it's not your Shire. Others dwelt here before hobbits, and others will dwell here again when hobbits are no more. Mm-hmm. The wild world is about you. You can fence yourselves in, but you cannot forever fence it out.
I love that line. I think that's pretty fascinating.
That's a hobbit world-shattering line right there.
Absolutely. And it's especially interesting because, as we've discussed many times before, like, Tolkien has constructed the Shire as, like, his idyllic England.
Yeah.
With the fields and farms and forests that he wants to walk through. And in many ways, he is Bilbo and the Hobbit, you know, setting off on his adventure, and he's a little bit peculiar. And so the Shire is, like, his perfect world, and he doesn't want it to change. And yet this is a, like, very frank and direct acknowledgement that the Shire is filled with people who kind of fear the outside and are ignorant of their past to the extent that they're trying to fence themselves off, but all they're doing is fencing themselves in. And
right.
Gildor, being the wise elder, sees far beyond that. Yeah, I like the line a lot.
Me too. All right, let's keep moving, though, because now we're short on time.
Okay.
All right. So Gildor, like, he starts to mention, he's just like, well, with your courage, you should be able to handle the road, which is like, really? Like, all right, courage is all it's going to take, which is kind of cool, yeah. But all right. And he's like, but you should also consult Gandalf. And then Frodo's like, well, that's another thing. Gandalf's missing. Mm-hmm. And then Gildor says, like, oh, that is bad news. But, you know, don't go messing with wizards. You can wait or go. And Frodo's just like, that was a pretty classic line. He's like, go not to the elves for counsel, for they will say both no and yes. But Frodo pulls out that line, and then he actually gets an answer from Gildor. So Gildor basically goes, he's like, okay, if you want my advice, go at once. Don't wait for Gandalf, but don't go alone. Bring trusty friends. And then word for word here, he says, now you should be grateful, for I do not give counsel gladly. The elves have their own labors and their own sorrows, and they are little concerned with the ways of hobbits or of any other creature upon earth. Our paths cross there seldom, by chance or purpose. In this meeting, there may be more than chance, but the purpose is not clear to me, and I fear to say much. So, this to me is the chance, purpose, paths crossing. I think this goes back to the road mm-hmm. thing. This is providential that they were supposed right. to meet. Like, this was supposed to help them along. This is a magical night after, at the very least, seeing some creepy things right. all day. And so, this is... Frodo needed to meet Gildor here because he needed somebody to encourage him. And you're hearing the wise counsel of this elf. And that I think that helps mm-hmm. him out a lot. Not to mention there's already physical safety for the night. Not to mention he's kind of is giving him advice about what to do here. He's like, all right, if Gandalf doesn't come, bring friends. Don't go alone. You know, like, go at once to Rivendell. Hopefully you're still on time. I think you can make it through as long as you're as courageous as you seem to be.
Mm-hmm. It was also, well... Maybe it's a good reality check for a second with Gildor's line that elves are little concerned with the ways of hobbits or of any other creatures upon the earth, because they've been portrayed in the book in the past, and it's easy to think of them as sort of these almost like nature spirits or something that are at one with the woods and the stars, and they can speak to the animals, and they represent nature and harmony, sort of, in which case they are like consistently altruistic. And just like looking out for the good of things, including Frodo and his companions on the road. but this is a little bit of a sharper line where it's like, no, we've got things to take care of. We're not really in the business of helping you guys out.
Well, I mean, I think that goes back to kind of that elusive quality about them.
And as the mortals don't totally understand their intentions or their goals.
Right. Frodo goes on, though. He's just saying, like, you know, he hears all this from Gildor, but he's just like, well, what about these Black Riders? Come on, please tell me more. Gildor says to him, is it not enough to know that they are servants of the enemy? Flee them. Speak no words to them. They are deadly. Ask no more of me. But my heart forebodes that, ere all is ended, you, Frodo son of Drogo, will know more of these fell things than Gildor and Glorion. May Elbereth protect you. Actually, just to finish it up here too, and Frodo's asking, like, well, where can I find courage? And Gildor's like, well, probably in unlikely places. For now, though, go to sleep. I will alert all the wandering companies of elves, because there's multiple groups than just Gildor's here, of your journey, and so all the powers of good will be on watch to help you out. So I think that's kind of an encouraging finish to it.
Right.
You know, he's asking Elbereth to protect him. We were just going over who Elbereth is. But he's also foreshadowing big time, like, hey, you're gonna know who these things are better than me, even though you don't know right now, which is also dark.
Big foreshadowing.
But it's also encouraging, though. It's like, all right, whatever help we got out here, you got the help of the elves, not just me, not just our company. We usually don't care, but we're going to care in this case. So we got your back.
Which seems like pretty darn good luck or a pretty good thing to hear at this point in the journey. If you've got a bunch of these elves who seem to know everything looking out for you. On the flip side, though, when I got to this point, you know, we're like, we've got our three hobbits. They're just trying to make their journey across the Shire, and things turn dark pretty quickly with two encounters with a Black Rider. And then the elves come and save the day, basically. But now the elves are saying, you know, sleep well. We'll be gone in the morning, and are just peacing out, basically. And so I was kind of thinking, I we're obviously concerned for Frodo and Pippin and Sam going forwards.
Well, for the purposes of the story, you can't have elves traveling with you the entire time. Like, that's too easy.
No, of course not. Of course not. But you just think, like, this Black Rider heard the elves scattered. It can't be that far away.
Right. Right.
So danger still feels like it's lurking.
But they've walked very far from the spot of the Black Rider.
Okay. Fair.
And they're off road too. Like, I think they're in like woods, like barely even following paths. I don't know. All right, let's move on just to the final thing real quick though.
Okay.
So I said like we'd visit the drafts of everything really quick. And so like, we'll harp on this for the first part of the first half of this book, how far Tolkien got in the story without knowing what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, it's very typical, like, writers get, like, a burst of inspiration, and then they start writing their story, and then they kind of just work their way to finish it off. But it's kind of the opposite for Tolkien. He starts just plugging away at something. He's like, all right, they want a sequel. And even The Hobbit, he was kind of just plugging away at it until, like, it didn't really start developing until Bilbo got the ring and got to Mirkwood, really.
Mm-hmm.
But for this especially, he's just like, all right, they want a sequel. All right, well, let's just dive in and start doing stuff. I don't know what my plot is. I don't really know the end goal here, but I'm just going.
Right.
I'm going for it. And so that scene where the Black Rider was coming up, I just want to go over real quick. Here was the first draft of it. The sound of hooves drew near. Round a turn came a white horse, and on its saddle a bundle, or that is what it looked like. A small man wrapped entirely in a great cloak and hood so that only his eyes peered out, and his boots in the stirrup below. All right, the horse stopped when it came level with Bingo. Remember, Frodo's name was Bingo at this time.
Yeah, which is hilarious.
The figure uncovered his nose and sniffed, and then sat silent as if listening. Suddenly a laugh came from inside his hood. Bingo, my boys, said Gandalf, throwing aside his wrappings. You and your lads are somewhere about. Come along now and show up. I want a word with you. And then the draft just ends, because Tolkien basically gets a better idea.
Right.
And the original draft is like, okay, Gandalf was going to show up. Whereas in this actual, like, the final chapter here, like, that's a central point, is that Gandalf's not here and he's supposed to be the entire time.
Right.
But as Tolkien was going for, he's just like, okay, we'll just have Gandalf show up. And then, like, he immediately, because, like, most of these drafts, like, they keep going, but he immediately just stops this one. And it's like, oh, wait, I got a better idea. He does, like, a second draft of this. And in the second draft, he makes the horse black. He makes it, like, the full-size rider. And it's exactly what we just saw in that scene with the Black Rider. Mm-hmm. And then he also basically, you know, not word for word, but he basically gets all the other stuff in one big stroke. Like, he gets all the elves coming up, he gets like the Black Rider showing up a second time, and you know, all of it, which is pretty impressive. So this is way back in, I don't know, 1938, I think. Maybe 19, yeah, I think 1938.
Cool window into Tolkien hashing out the details.
Yeah, like I can't really imagine anybody being able to do this today, because now everything's probably just typed out, and you know, you probably just edit it. It's like, maybe you'd be lucky to even save a first draft and then start a different document on your computer as a second draft, you know?
Right.
So it's pretty unique that we can still get all this, and he like saved all his notes in some cluster of an office. Yeah. Like his kid Christopher Tolkien had like such a headache trying to compile all this together. Like, it's extremely impressive, and we should be grateful for that, whether you're a major fan or not. All right, Clifford, how you been?
I've been really good, Patrick. Nice. Got a new apartment, and things are looking up.
Nice.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. I don't know. Lots. I've been busy, but lots of different stuff going on. Okay, I got a review here.
Okay.
Awesome. Let's see which one to read. Actually, I'm gonna do this shorter review. I got a longer review, but we're coming off a long episode, so I don't want to read that one. Okay, 5 stars. Off to a great start. I enjoyed Chapter 1 podcast. A short summary of the chapter, and then lots of background detail that are not well known. Great for anyone who loves LOTR. Alright, that was very simple. That review gets a beer koozie. So, anybody can do that. Thank you for the review, too. You can write reviews on iTunes. TalkingTolkienPodcast.com is our email if you have any questions for us or want to get in contact for some reason.
Yeah.
Oh, we got to talk about Instagram. Okay, go to our Instagram. What's our Instagram?
Talking Tolkien Podcast.
Yeah. All right, fun stuff. So we're putting up pictures of all the characters, major characters in the book, for a special project. And so we're looking for people to leave comments on a scale of 1 to 10, like how well crafted of a character is this by Tolkien. You're not judging the art itself. The art's really good, but yeah.
What if it's a character I don't like very much?
All right, so that's the deal. Well crafted means it's somebody who, like, Gollum's a really well crafted character. I don't really like Gollum, but I'm not really supposed to like him, which means he should get a higher score for that, you know, because he does his job well. That it's like, oh, you make me really emotionally charged, Gollum. 10 out of 10.
But I don't like him.
I know. So you're aware that you're not you're aware of that. Same with I don't want to say other characters in the future. All right, same with like Smaug. Smaug should be really high too, because it's like, oh, I don't really like Smaug, but it's like, well, he was really well crafted, you know. This, like, he's basically like a James Bond villain at the least expected moment ever, you know.
So I should go to the Instagram, and there's all these characters, and what am I supposed to do there?
Just leave a comment, 0 through 10. You know, you can, rookie scores are whole numbers, but, you know, I've had some 11s, but they're just going to be factored in as 10s for our project. And,
how do I express my excitement about Tom Bombadil?
I don't think we put up Tom yet. We're going to have to do him soon. Maybe I'll...
Okay, well, when you do, I'm going to vote 11.
Okay, well, fair. Wait, Clifford, no, this is going out tonight. We can't talk about Bombadil.
Oh, shoot. Okay, never mind.
Not for another 4 chapters. Okay. Or 2, 3. Whatever. Okay. I think we should probably leave it there, because now this episode's getting long.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
Everybody have a good week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, y'all.